We'll move back to case number one on our 9 o'clock docket, Mantos versus City of Mansfield. Ms. Mock.
May it please the court, Mr. Todd Hutton to argue for appellant and Mr. Chris Quatz to argue for City of Mansfield appellee.
We have a correction there.
Yeah, Mr. Wood here is going to argue.
Okay.
Here for moral support.
Okay. Thank you. All right, Mr. Hutton.
Thank you. My apologies for being a few minutes late this morning. I had a docket that showed a party before us, and apparently that was wrong information, and I do apologize for that.
That's fine. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. We're here today on a matter that's of public interest. I'm a public interest attorney at heart. I also do real work to earn a living. And my client, Ms. Mantos, is a concerned citizen in the city she lives in. And since 2004, when I first met her, we've looked at various transactions and business dealings, so to speak, in the city of Mansfield and other places too. But we've seen inescapable patterns in the city of Mansfield. Epley in this case, that really were of such scope and of such entrenched, ways and ongoing dealings with the city in virtually every aspect of its functions. It's a little business over there. It's kind of the way it's treated from our perspective, and so. As they do these projects, we learn that there might be something worth looking into. And this is in fact, not the first project in Mansfield that's been challenged. They make much of that. I would say that's a badge of honor. There's few citizens today that are willing to step up and hold their government to account. And really, we're talking about an open meetings case here. And the reason the legislature enacted the Texas Open Meetings Act was just for that, for citizens to be able to oversee government actions. And that's all we're doing here. That's why we're here today. My client would like the opportunity to oversee what her government is doing with her money. She owns a business there. She owns a home there. She pays a lot of property taxes there. And when you find over and over that your city council is meeting behind closed doors, and you never really know what's going on. You know, there's land transactions flying here, flying there. You find out that a 40-acre park is missing. You find out that eventually a group of people who were awarded supposed requests for bids would later end up with a $65 million tax incentive to develop a project or to sell the land that was embellished with those incentives. Those things raise red flags, and we began looking into them. So as I was preparing for today, something struck me that, kind of what this is about. And I'm kind of a patriotic guy, the kind of a sentimental heart, and things mean things to me. And when I read them, I try to extrapolate from the previous leaders of our country and the wisdom that they passed down to us and learn from that and want to carry that on for them, carry that torch of goodness in America. And I was struck that, it's one Thursday afternoon, November 19th, 1863, It was in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And amid a sea of corpses, some by then dead for months, where a United States president, in closing one of the most powerful speeches in American history, used what have become some of the most recognizable words in American culture. He said, in closing, "We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation shall have a new birth of freedom, and that this government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth." And that really is what we're talking about today, a government of the people, by the people, for the people. The problem is the people have been locked out. When the back door closes and the executive session starts, it's no longer of the people, by the people, for the people. It's of the few, for the friends. You know, it breaks apart. The system falls apart. You know, Lincoln found himself back at that time. He was at the helm of a nation in meltdown. Things were really coming apart at the seams. I mean, the nation was basically almost gone. He was about to lose control. And so what did he do? He did the only thing he could do. He reminded folks that America was worthy of preservation. Though the circumstances were grave, Lincoln's powerful message derives from the simplicity of its solutions. So long as the people could retain control of their own government, America would survive. Moreover, she'd remain worthy of that survival. The requisite power was restored to the people instantly. With nothing more than words, President Lincoln thereby reestablished a foothold for liberty and the reason for freedom. It's a open government and government by the people is a mindset. It's a mindset that people either buy off on or they don't. And it permeates everything you do. I've been a mayor before. I've been in the city councils. I know the inner workings of these things. And you either believe in this stuff or you don't. That's kind of where you draw the lines. But whether you do or don't, the fact is the legislature has said that that is the public policy of the state of Texas. Open government is the policy of this state. And that's through rendition of the Open Meetings Act and Public Information Act, there are various acts. The federal government has the FOIA. There's everywhere you turn, there's ways to access government. And those are there not just because legislatures just one day said, well, why don't we just get a bunch of nosy citizens down poking into everybody's business? No, they realized that that was, in fact, the backbone of this democracy and republic. Unless the people are involved and understand what their government's doing, it's not of the people anymore. And at that point in time, when we've lost control of what's happening, we can look around the world and see what it leads to. Our freedoms will be lost. Our liberty will be lost. Our country will be lost. Just as it almost was that day there in Gettysburg when Lincoln, through great wisdom, so simple, just reminded people that so long as they were in control, everything would be fine. And it was. They pulled out. I might add there too, in addition to being public policy, you know, you can track back the history, the origins of open government laws and whatnot, but what you'll find, the common denominator between them all is that conceptually, open government is derived from First Amendment principles, such as free speech, freedom of the press, and the right to petition the government. And in this regard, open government is really more than mere public policy. It's a foundational principle, as I was saying. It's something you either do it or you don't. You live it or you hate it. It's the very footing upon which liberty rests and without which freedom will die. Without open government, there can be no oversight, of the people. Without oversight, there can be no accountability, by the people. And without accountability, there will be no longer any freedom, for the people. So again, that is just a premise. That's the way I look at these laws, and that's why they're so important to me. That's why they're worthy of the work that it takes to prosecute this kind of thing. Public interest cases, you know, or not. Like as I said, this is not my job where I can really earn a living because there's just no money. Nobody can afford to do this stuff. You know, it's kind of something you do as a labor of love.
Mr. Hutton, can you now move more towards why we are here today and what issues you have in front of this court allow this litigation to proceed further?
Yes. And that is, Your Honor, with all due respect, that is why we're here. That is the big picture of why we're here. You know, whether there's, you know, ratifications or validations or all these underlying issues that we're going to talk about, all those are you know, interesting fodder. But the bottom line is the citizens ought to know what their government's doing, especially when they're giving away $65 million. So that's the premise. I've noticed in going through let me back up and go to where you would like to go first. This case involves, as the court is probably aware by now, a series of transactions in land that, starting back in 2004, the city of Mansfield engaged upon a course of compiling basically what would end up being a 105-acre tract of land. And that was done through, there was a 40-acre, and these are round numbers, roughly a 40-acre purchase of land for $7 million, an adjoining 40-acre donation for roughly the same value, the same price that the 40 acres were purchased for. So that 80 acres has about a $15 million acquisition value, we'll call it. And then there was a neighboring property that was around, it was several more acres, 26 acres, I believe, total 105, for another couple of million. So basically we're up to $15 million and change for the acquisition of this 105-acre tract. At the time, it was widely understood that part of that land was going to have some kind of a sports park type thing on it. But ultimately, that project got moved, and the city, around the time the park was getting moved, had advertised a request for proposals for someone to come in and develop this 105-acre tract. And the bid that they published requested that potential developers submit bids to purchase 65 acres plus or minus of land, the other 40 of the 105 being at that time contemplated for this other park. Well, meanwhile, that two bids came in, and there was rumblings within the community on where that 40-acre park was going in on that 105 acre that they've compiled right over there, kind of around a nice area of the town. And there were some rumblings from the residents that were going to neighbor this now new ballpark with all of its lights and, you know, all the sirens and everything. And eventually the city kind of bowed to that public pressure and decided they were going to move that park. So now they've already advertised for bids for 65 acres of 105. They're going to move the park, so they got 40 left. Well, just so happens it's that same 40 that I mentioned earlier that was donated to the city as a park. The record shows clearly that there were gift deeds involved. You know, these transactions are all documented.
But do the gift deeds include the reservation or condition that would be reflected in the deed records as to the use of the properties?
Well, they reflect that it was a gift deed, and I believe, I don't have the stipulation in, you know, verbatim here, but that it was the conveyance, the gift was on the condition that it be used as for public purposes, and including, and at that time was that public purpose was that 40-acre park that was going to be go in.
But that was in connection with the agreement, the side contractual agreement between the donor and the city. Isn't that right?
Side contractual. You lost me on that. I don't.
Okay.
So the person that would have standing to complain about that is the donor.
Well, and that's not our complaint in and of itself. These are just the things that have been flushed out.
Can we get to your complaint?
Yeah, our complaint is that all this happened behind closed doors in violation of the Texas Open Meetings Act. There were never sufficient agendas. There was never sufficient public deliberation of these various decisions that were made to basically, to do all this, to reams of paper, you know, to title the land, to switch the land, all the contracting. You know, there was literally hundreds of various decisions that had to be made and executed, and none of which were decided on or deliberated or even mentioned in a public forum. They weren't on any agenda. There's no agenda that ever mentions that the city accepted a 40-acre donation. There's no agenda that says it ever sold a 40-acre donation. In fact, the initial meeting that we're complaining about was January 24th, 2005, and that was the meeting where they decided that they were, instead of the 65 acres that they built or advertised for bid, since the park had now moved, they decided that, well, you know, 65, 105, you know, pretty close, we'll just go ahead and use that same advertisement and that same submittal back in and just change it and sell the whole thing to these people, the successful bidder. So that is a problem in that you have an agenda, a posted agenda, talking about awarding, a bid based on a 65-acre proposal that, by the way, required the bidder to include in the package if they wanted any public incentives. And so they award the bid based on 65-acre advertisement. Turns out the whole 105 acres was encumbered by various means that would make your eyes roll back. Some of them were, there was assignments, there were subrogations, there were licenses to use. I mean, all different imaginable ways to encumber this track, and none of it that I've found any evidence of was ever paid for. After the city compiled it, they simply deeded it over to their buddies in the back room. And notably, on this sale issue, when you go into executive session under TOMA, the Texas Open Meetings Act, there's certain specified exceptions to the open meeting. That's executive sessions. You can go in there. And if you look at the itemized list there, there's lease, exchange, some other things that deal with it. But sale is specifically excluded there because when you're selling land, just like when you advertise for bid, you don't want to be talking about selling your land in secret. You want as many people to know about your land sale as possible.
All right, Mr. Hutton, your 15 minutes is now complete. You will have a rebuttal period.
Thank you, Chair.
All right, Mr. Wood.
Thank you, ma'am. Police Court. Steve Wood, representing the City of Mansfield today.
Is this the ballpark with the super-duper softball fields?
It involved some acquisition by land, and originally it was intended that ballpark be on this property. I'm going to refer to the property. It's a 105-acre track. I'm going to refer to that as the Mansfield property. That's how we refer to it in our brief. It's 105 acres located on 287 Broad Street in the city there. The city acquired that property in the fall of 2004, and in the fall of 2005 began, I'm sorry, in the spring of 2005 began looking at ways to develop the property. That was one of the intended uses originally for that property. It was the Big League Dream site. 40 acres of that was to be used for Big League Dreams. Turns out the citizens didn't really want the park at that site, and so at some point during that year, they did acquire other property to move the Big League Dreams project over, and that's actually in the record as part of what happened in this case. Before I get into the legal argument, I do want to take exception with some of the things that were said today about the facts. If you'll notice, the appellant statement of facts is full of lots of argument and does not contain any citations, hardly at all, to the record. There's a reason for that. If I could characterize the appellant statements of fact, it would be strictly conjecture and speculation. Okay. There is no evidence in the record that any portion of the Mansfield property was ever designated as a park by the city. Okay? It's not in the record. In fact, they even say in their reply brief, the city never so much as uttered the word park in public. Well, there's a reason for that. They never designated this any portion of that property to be a park. So the allegation that there was a park given away is just not supported by the record. Also, there was a statement made that the city gave away $65 million. I honestly don't know what that is referring to. That's the first time I've heard it, and it's not in the record. He referred to the value of the land. That's not in the record. He refers to city giving away things to the buddies behind closed doors. I don't know what to say to that. That's just not in the record. So you guys can read our statement of facts and make your own decisions there. But the city, in essence, was faced with an Open Meetings Act lawsuit filed by the plaintiff for an appellant in this case on May 1st of 2008. The city raised three affirmative defenses for the trial court in a motion for summary judgment. The first was that, according to the Governmental Validation Act, all of the city's actions that took place prior to May 1st of 2005 have been validated and are not subject to dispute because none of the exceptions to validation found in the Act apply. The Validation Act is found in 51.03 of the Local Government Code. The second issue or affirmative defense was the defense of latches, and the third was one we call ratification, okay? As far as the Validation Act goes, the Validation Act basically says all governmental acts or proceedings of a municipality, okay, are presumed valid and in compliance with all statutes. That would include bidding statutes, that would include the Open Government, Open Meetings Act, Public Information Act, that type of thing. If they are not challenged within 3 years, okay, unless an exception applies. So our first point here is that we believe that it's undisputed that all of the actions of the city council whereby they acquired the property and authorized the sale and disposition of the property took place prior to May 1st of 2005. That's undisputed. The only thing that took place after that time was the actual closing of the disposition of the 105 acres. And that is something that we don't believe is something that can be challenged because it is not the final act of the council. That final act had already taken place on March 14th, 2005. The closing is just basically the city manager carrying out the instructions or the staff carrying out the instructions and authorization of the council.
And were the ordinances that were passed, did they also take place 3 years prior?
More than 3 years prior, yes, ma'am. And that brings up the ratification argument. The specific actions that were challenged in this case, if you read the pleadings, were those actions taken by the city council on January 24th of 2005. The only thing that really happened on that day is that the city council authorized by motion for the staff to prepare the conveyance instruments, okay, to acquire the new property for the Big Ling Dream site and to sell the property that was bid to the bidder that got the award, which is DCB Properties is how we refer to them in our brief. So that's the only really actions that they formally challenged in their lawsuit. But even if there were some problem, if the court said, you know, they didn't have an agenda posting right or something was problematic with what happened on that day, the purpose of the Open Meetings Act is to ensure that the people know what's going on in their city. In Mansfield, I mean, I agree with what Todd said as far as, you know, the policies behind open government. Mansfield agrees with those policies. And if any citizen wanted to know exactly what happened in Mansfield prior to the date of the closing, which was on May 20th of 05, all they would have had to have done was come to the meeting on March 14th of 2005, and they would have seen the City Council pass two ordinances. Those ordinances specifically authorized the sale of the property to the DCB entities and the purchase and acquisition of the other property for the Big League Dream site. So there is no question that the citizens of Mansfield were informed exactly what took place as far as these transactions. And so we feel like even if there were some prior problems, I mean, the city has informed its citizens of exactly what it did by the way of passing these two ordinances. The other thing that the city raised as a defense is the defense of latches. Now, this is actually a very interesting legal question to me, because I haven't seen it come up in any other case. But can a citizen challenge an action of a government under the Open Meetings Act 3 years after the date that those decisions were made? Now, the Open Meetings Act itself does not contain a specific statute of limitations, and most courts, because of that, use the default limitations of 4 years under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. But in this case, we're talking about transactions where the city is spending time and money, and the developer is spending money. In the record, it actually says that three things happened after the city passed its ordinances authorizing these transactions. The city applied for and received a $3 million grant from the state for the development of the property. It entered into a development agreement with an entity called Forest City to develop this property as a retail shopping center that was going to bring millions of dollars in revenue into the city. And the developer itself spent about $3 million in pre-construction costs in furtherance of the project. So, you know, 3 years later, we've got millions of dollars being spent in furtherance of this project, and all of a sudden we're hit with an Open Meetings Act lawsuit that causes a hold on the project. And in fact, today, they've testified to this in their brief. The project is dead. It is dead, okay? It's hard. It's hard to say. So the question is, can a person slumber on their rights in this case? Waiting 3 years after all this time and effort and money is spent to bring up this Open Meetings Act challenge when they had notice. I mean, there was an agenda, and they had the ordinances. So they had notice on the day of these, you know, decisions were made. They had notice of any potential violations. And so they could have brought this sooner, but they didn't. And that was really harmful, I think, to the city, prejudicial to the city in that sense.
What does the city say in regard to the claims that too much business was handled in executive session as opposed to within city council meetings?
Well, and this is one area of fundamental disagreement that we have with the plaintiff. In fact, the last thing the plaintiff says, appellant says in the appellant's brief, forgive me, is, and in the end, this entire case boils down to a single yes or no question. Did the city deliberate the challenged transactions in public as required by the Texas Open Meetings Act? The only reasonable answer is no. Now, the problem is that question assumes something. It assumes that the Open Meetings Act requires public deliberation of the transactions of the city, and it doesn't. The Open Meetings Act requires the final actions of the City Council to be made in a public meeting, but it does not require the City Council to sit up there and discuss anything. In fact, if you look at the city's agendas, all cities' agendas have a section called the consent agenda, and that's where they just put something on the agenda. There's usually no discussion about it. A motion is made to approve the consent agenda. It's voted on and passed or denied. And that act would be in compliance with the Open Meetings Act, because the citizens can look at the consent agenda, look at the things on there, and determine what actions took place. And that is the minimum standard for the Open Meetings Act. So the fact that the City Council may not have engaged in lengthy deliberations in an open meeting does not mean that they violated the act. And I would also dispute with the appellant that there were no public deliberations. But since we didn't really argue the merits of the claims before the trial court, that evidence is not necessarily in the record. So that's all I have, unless you have any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. Rebuttal, Mr. Hutton.
Thank you. I'm a little bit bewildered here for some of the things I heard, but just as a starting point, the Open Meetings Act clearly does require deliberation in public. In fact, when decisions are made in executive session, the council walks out, reconvenes, sits down, says, well, we'll call item 2B, whatever. Do I have a motion? Motion to approve. Aye. Okay, motion passes. Next item. That's not an open meeting. That is not open government. That is you being able to read basically what happened.
Well, are you disputing the Open Meetings Act, or are you disputing what occurred? You just told us what should occur, and I'm asking you, are you saying that the Open Meetings Act requires more, or are you saying that the Open Meetings Act should require
more? No, it certainly does require more as drafted. If it didn't, we wouldn't be here.
Where in the Open Meetings Act do we look? If we can get specific for a moment.
Let's see. That's going to take me a minute to find that exact provision. But I could. How about a follow-up with a letter brief? A letter brief I could follow up with?
It's in your brief.
It's in there. It's in there, and the case laws have done that too. I think it's the Espinoza case. It's pretty good on that point. It's a federal court case. But since I am limited on time here, I would like to say that one thing I want to touch on is our objections to the summary judgment evidence that were not ruled on, or at least not expressly ruled on by the trial court.
Clarify for me, why did your client have 3 years to file a lawsuit?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. Here is why. Okay, remember remember the request for bids back in 04 that they awarded, late 04 into 05. They changed it from 65 to 81, and then it turns out it was really 105 that were encumbered. That request for proposal specifically states in it, and it's in the record, that all applicants, bidders, need to place in their proposal if they want any public incentives for the project. Okay, that is part of what the city will evaluate these things on. In other words, if one bidder comes in there and says, we're going to build you a marble palace lined with gold, and the other one says, well, we're going to build you a lean-to, but, without more, you're going to go for the palace. But then you read the fine print down there, and it says, but, oh, by the way, we need $1 billion in public incentives to do it. That's a material part of awarding the bid. And that part of this project, as you just heard, was just recently, the project's over now, but they continued discussing those particular parameters of the agreement for years. And it wasn't until August 07, when it first was released in a kind of a press release thing. It wasn't on an agenda or anything like that. It was a press release stating that the city was offering $65 million in incentives to bring this development to Mansfield. So that then gave significance to all the stuff that had been going on for years. Now we understood why they needed the 105 acres. Now we understood why, these things move forward in time. And it was upon that realization that we started gearing up and investigating the claim, and then we filed it within 10 months of learning of that. Once the numbers and what was really going to happen on that land came to light, that's when we challenged it. And I mean, that's just a simple fact of the matter. So in other words, under their theory is that we've hid this so well for so long that you've just missed your chance. Well, that's not the way it works. You know, I would argue a discovery rule at a minimum there. And the Validation Act was originally, it's contemplated for things like annexation and those kinds of things that you need finality for, so you can get your maps drawn and people can build their houses in the right town and whatnot. It's not for things like this that go on for years under the radar. When your house gets annexed into a city, you know it. You know, it's not hidden for 3 or 4 years and then they say, aha, you know, here's your new tax bill. That's why we have a Validation Act, to stop, you know, give finality to things. That's not the case here. As long as you're going to continue negotiating these things in secret, and all these are executive sessions as well, we can't challenge it until we know what we're challenging. And the minute we found out, that's what we did. Thank you.
Mr. Hutton, we thank you for your arguments today and your briefing. Mr. Wood and Mr. Olson, we appreciate your appearances here today and your briefing as well. Your case is submitted and you all are excused.
Whatever y'all want.